Alright, honey, it's time once again for Truth the Fab Markets! Now in its fifth year!
Wow, 5 years. God, every single time I hear that noise, that music. Karma Bing!
Yeah.
It does make me think of London, of Residence 104.4 FM.
It sure does. It just has kind of an exciting feel about it.
Max is getting himself organized here. He has glasses on.
That's right. The better to read the chaos in the paper by.
Max just got his first pair of glasses ever.
Isn't that exciting?
I think people will be excited. I'm excited. It's taking some getting used to.
I'll say for me too.
Why are you talking like that?
Ah, yeah, that's a good question. So what are some of these, this is interesting here, you know, the credit crunch in Dubai. You know, they built that huge development, the world.
Oh, yeah, where each little island that on which sat somebody's house was a part of the world. So there was Somalia, Afghanistan, Brazil.
That's right. Sir Richard Branson owned England, and some rock star owned Scotland.
I think Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie owned one of the African countries.
Right. So this is huge development in the Persian Gulf that was reclaimed land. And because of the credit crunch, it's gone. Basically, they've stopped work on this thing.
I like that I'm only seeing a picture over your shoulder. It says, it's a picture of some of this... island development. It's not even reclaimed land. It's just land that was put out into the middle of the Persian Gulf, or the Arabian Gulf, as they call it here.
Mm-hmm.
The world is now a shipping hazard.
That's right.
Why? It's in the way of ships?
Yeah, it's just jutting out there in the middle of the Gulf, and no one's really out there, and it's become this huge multi-hundred-billion-dollar catastrophe. You know, a few years ago, there was that famous photo circulating on the internet that showed downtown Dubai 2 years ago versus 10 years ago. And 10 years ago was maybe one building and a lot of desert. And then it was this huge development with Dubai Fantasyland and hotels and all this stuff going on. And everyone was saying, look, that's where all America's money is going. You see, the Mideast is going to be thriving in this inflationary bubble that's being created because of all the money being injected. But that was wrong too. So apparently it's a huge you know, that's going back to the desert.
Well, so what happened? So, you know, house prices there have fallen by 50%.
Yeah.
And remember, this is 50% since December. And just recall, oh, people out there in London, what all those programs on BBC, Channel 4, ITV, they were all pushing their own brand of buy property in Dubai. You know, they had all sorts of programs, one fronted by Piers Morgan. Everything made it look so great there. But house prices are down there 50% since December.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently it's been just entirely bailed out by Abu Dhabi, their... you know, the real capital region of the UAE.
Mm, yeah.
And the only ones that actually have genuine oil wealth, in that the only state in the UAE that has oil wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Dubai has none or very little.
Mm.
And but on the surface, they looked the richer of the Emirates.
Well, apparently, you know, Saudi Arabia and the banks in Saudi Arabia and the banks in the Mideast are getting ready to announce huge write-offs. Apparently the banks in the Mideast are really in the worst shape of any banks in the world.
Yeah, I saw that. I didn't get a chance to read it yet, but so the Saudi king, or the central bank, the Saudi central bank is refusing, they're saying, to bail out two big banks that have all sorts of bad debts.
Yep. And of course there's a huge counterparty claims with other banks around the world and banks on Wall Street. So the next big credit crunch, maybe it starts. I mean, the credit crunch that started in 2007 and had the big event about a year ago with the collapse of Lehman Brothers, I guess you could kind of say that started on Wall Street. I think that's a fair guess.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about this is in the in the Gulf, you obviously have Sharia banking or Islamic banking. So their own customers don't have massive amounts of debts, obviously. Their own retail customers. The same thing with France. Very, very difficult to open bank accounts here. Almost impossible to go overdraft. Same thing in Germany. Obviously, Germans don't spend on credit cards. They have one of the lowest rates of credit card usage in the world, the highest savings rates. And yet all their banks themselves still suffered hugely by buying U.S. toxic debts and loaning money to these private equity firms.
Yeah, well, this is the triumph of the cult of magical Wall Street thinking and the idea that you could take on all this debt, and if you had the right mathematical algorithmic programs in your computers, you could take on all this incredible amount of debt and you would not be at risk. And everyone bought into this because the Wall Street magical thinkers are in the banking system, in the central banking system in countries all over the world. So even though the local populations in France or Germany and elsewhere were prudent and saving and doing really, maintaining a certain level of rational behavior, the top guys at the top banks were behaving in this cult-like model that said there was no limit to the amount of debt you could take on as long as you had these algorithmic trading programs in place that were going to somehow distribute the risk in ways that made it impossible for any one bank to be vulnerable to the point of failure. And, okay, so what we learned was this was poppycock and that all the risk was concentrated in a few banks who blew up, and then this was the credit crunch that we know. So apparently the next leg of the crunch, though, if the first leg started on Wall Street, maybe what we're saying here is that the next leg, the next big leg down would maybe come from the Mideast, and then it would filter out to other banks around the world. This would be interesting because then you have like Wall Street and would be able to point the finger at some other country at that point. So that'll be interesting.
Well, the next leg down, you've also got Europe, Austria. Remember, well over 100% of Austria's GDP is exposed to loans to Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
There was another interesting story that I have posted on MaxKaiser.com today, because you brought up derivatives and these algorithmic trading. Now, algorithmic trading, of course, can only happen with an algorithm, which is applied via a software product. Mm. Well, it turns out that Lehman Brothers, and probably everybody here has seen all the one-year anniversary sort of stuff from the collapse of Lehman Brothers last year. Well, it turns out they're trying to unwind. They're still trying to unwind their derivatives book.
Yeah.
Now, there's a massive problem, and that is that they don't have anybody able to decipher or use the software because they each have their own software.
Mm-hmm.
But because it was up to like 20% more to actually that the company would have had to spend to document the software and how it was developed.
Right.
There's no documentation of how the software was developed.
Yeah, that's a common issue in your software developer. We have that issue ourselves with Pirate My Film. We've got software developers, and to ask them to document the development of the software so you can, if the developer leaves and somebody else comes in, they can see how the software is developed. It does add cost and time, and people don't bother to have documented software. And so what you're saying is that the proprietary so-called software that was developed over at Lehman to create the magical banking formula of taking on infinite debt and not exposing yourself to any risk is unreadable because they didn't document any of the software. So they've got all this paper that only has value to the extent that they can decipher the software, but they can't decipher the software. So does that mean that the paper has a value of zero?
Well, yeah, there's apparently something like $30 trillion in notional value.
Yeah.
And, it's about as, you're going to have to get one of these archaeologists that you always see on all these Egyptian programs on the BBC. It's always that one guy who sits there and shows you some writing on the wall in an ancient Egyptian pyramid and say, we haven't yet deciphered this, mm-hmm. but we think it means this. So that's basically what it is. There's a bunch of people looking at it and examining the code and trying to figure out
mm-hmm.
how they created the so-called value on these derivatives.
Well, the other point is that it's probably, when you do, if you could decipher it, you find that it has no value. It's like one of those Escher prints with the staircases that go up and create other staircases that create another staircase, and then you find you're at exactly where you started. You know, they've got those like a Mobius strip where there is you're constantly on the outside of the strip, and this is probably what they will find ultimately, is that all these derivative products refer to themselves, and that there is no value. It's a mere bag of formulations that was sold as having a value of 100 cents in the dollar, but it's really, it really has no value at all. And this was the natural end game of the whole derivatives history, which started with listed options back in the 70s, and it just became more, it became more exotic over the past 30 years, to the point now where it's become what I call financial narcissism. It's just bankers looking at themselves in the mirror and deciding that they're not worth a million, they're worth a billion. But there's no justification for it. But they go across the street and they sell bonds that really might have some worth of a million, maybe, and just say, oh, it's worth a billion. And then that bank says, okay, we'll pay you a billion as long as you buy one of our bonds. And you say that our bond's worth a billion. And they each charge each other a fee. And this goes on ad infinitum. The derivatives pile increases to over a quadrillion. Banks are making billions in bonuses. And then when they blow up, of course, as they must, the government bails them out. And Obama has been a complete failure on this score. He has allowed the banks to engage in the riskless casino capitalism model. And he has, if anything, fanned the flames of this malfeasance. And for this, he will really, it's unforgivable, I think.
It's unforgivable. Now, there's another story, this the so-called Phoenix Four.
The Keating Five?
Yeah, here's the headline. Well, here's a headline. No, the Keating Five were in a time when there used to be some sort of justice.
Who are the Phoenix Four?
The Phoenix Four are these four guys who bought MG Rover for £1.
Oh, yeah.
And it turns out they just, like, blew the whole company up, stole, well, not, they, the report says that there was some sort of deception involved in this. But the headline on the Times is called Sex, Lies, and Big Money Bonuses That Killed Rover. Mm-hmm. A damning report into the collapse of MG Rover claimed yesterday that one of its former directors attempted to destroy evidence about how the company went bust in 2005, and another was having a personal relationship with a consultant who was paid £1.6 million by the business. Mm-hmm. This is the point. The 850-page report began 4 years ago at a cost of £16 million to the taxpayer. And all they found out was, wow, these guys are plutocrats, they're oligarchs. Big deal. You know, unless we're going to do something about it, we have to accept. I'm so sick of this fake outrage and all these like reports of like, oh my God, look at how these people live. Look what they did. They paid their mistress £1.6 million out of like the taxpayer funds or the shareholders' money, and they blew it all up. Well, we're not going to do anything to stop it. So like,
no.
We should just more celebrate this. Like, because...
Yeah, because they're the lotto winners, aren't they?
Well, they're the lotto winners, but I maintain that we no longer have the American dream. We just have plutocratic hope. And that's, everybody hopes that they might be a plutocrat one day. So why don't we just get to see like the lifestyles of the rich and famous plutocrats? So we could see possibly one day, if we win the lottery, we might get to live like that too. And we might get to tear apart public, you know, infrastructure and shareholder value. We might be able to do this.
But, yeah, there is no. What are you saying?
Well, I'm just saying, like, unless we as a society force our governments to do something about it,
yeah,
then forget all the outrage. Because
yeah, what is this outrage all about?
Because they were plutocrats. Basically, they you know, while they drove the company into the ground, millions and millions of pounds they extracted for their own fees and salaries. They paid, you know, their mistresses, consultancy firms, millions of pounds, and the whole company went bust, and it cost the taxpayer money, and it was just, standard practice.
Let me follow up on that and see if what you think about this, okay? Because I was being interviewed last night by Jesse Ventura, okay? Governor Jesse Ventura. He's got a new show coming up on True TV. And this interview, I think, will be on in November. And he was talking to me about Goldman Sachs and all the nefarious activities of Goldman Sachs. And toward the end of the interview, they say to me, well, so in other words, you know, what you've described, that all the basically illegal activities of Goldman Sachs, so in other words, they've got a secret cabal. And it's every day in the front page of the Financial Times. There's nothing secret about it. So what prompts like a Governor Jesse Ventura to think that this isn't being done just in the open? You know, when I said to him, no, it's not secret, it's completely open. The question is, why do people allow this to happen? So I guess this is kind of feeding into your point. In other words, there's no point all the outrage is completely fake. I don't even, right? I
mean, well, exactly, because listen, people ask us all the time, like, how are you able to predict this? How did you know this? How are you able to foresee it? But, you know, you just spend 75 pence or 80 pence on the Financial Times. And they openly talk about it because, you know, they have financial writers that write about the stuff that's actually happening. Here, this Rover, MG Rover story, remember, we covered this as it was happening. It was all in the Financial Times. You know, they talk about it openly. Right. They understand what's happening. And now what? The taxpayer has to spend 16 million pounds. It's in order to create this fake outrage. So Lord Mandelson can say this is outrageous. And these guys should voluntarily disqualify themselves from holding any future directorships.
Yeah,
like,
everything's
voluntary.
The MG Rover deal, we talked about in detail on this show.
Yes.
When was this? In 2005?
2005.
Okay, for like 3 or 4 weeks.
It might not have been illegal, the acts of what they were doing, but it should be because, you know, it was unacceptable behavior. Because if everybody acts like this, and they all are, then you create a financial catastrophe. At that time, there was not yet the financial catastrophe, but we said everybody was doing this. Everybody was just stripping the assets of all their companies. Everybody was doing the same thing and plundering the public purse. All the oligarchs were. Celebrate oligarchs, so if we're, you know, we should allow them to destroy our economies and just, like,
those
celebrate
creative
it.
Destruction, isn't it?
Yeah, because if nobody cares about the plutocrats, if they're allowed to continue operating and nothing has been stopped, nothing has been changed, nobody has been prosecuted in the U.S.
They're a necessary agent of change. I mean, we saw that interesting show. They had a recreation of the last days of Lehman Brothers. It was a BBC show.
It was.
And one of the interesting points was over the weekend, when they were trying to figure out how to get through the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, the point is made, and Hank Paulson is represented in the movie and all the big bankers, and the point is made that the... I think one of the lines is, you know, the laws that this touches, that we're, you know, involved with here, haven't yet been written. Or anyway, the inference there is, yes, of course they're breaking laws. They're breaking laws that haven't even been written yet to be broken.
Exactly.
So now, as I've said on the show before, you know, working on Wall Street, this is always the mantra on Wall Street, is that if you're in the banking industry, you don't pay attention to the laws at all, because the feeling is that if there is a so-called transgression of the law, it's not that the problem is not that the law is being broken. It's that the law hasn't kept up with the innovations that are going on in the banking industry. And this is true on Wall Street and in the city of London. They're completely off the legal grid. You can't even say they're breaking the law, because these are laws that have not even been written yet. They're coming up with ways to innovate and financially engineer new products based on mathematical formulations that they care proprietary, that no one in the FSA or SEC has even looked at enough to pass a review. So they're living in a world that has no laws whatsoever. Now, it stands to reason that the corporations who have close relationships with these banks, and as corporations depend more and more on their income statement and their treasury and their chief financial officer to generate profits more than what's happening on the shop floor, you know, an MG Rover and any car company makes more money on their financing business than they do in selling cars. So it stands to reason then that the executives at these companies would take the same attitude as their bankers, which is that we don't live in a law-abiding world, because we're moving faster than the law can possibly keep up. And we want the law to go to school on us, because we're just taking this thing – to a point of creative destruction to creative to the future. And it's up to the legal experts to, you know, to catch up to us. And it doesn't work. I mean, if it would be...
Well, it does work until it's like there is much agents of change as like Marie Antoinette.
Right, you know, but...
Eventually.
Well, clearly, if you look at, for example, the crisis, here's another story, you know, in the students in the UK are facing chaos over loans. Okay, they've got 150,000 applicants, students applying for the money that they need to go to school, and their school starting, and they don't have the money to go. Now, this is the result of this idea where the bankers are speeding ahead faster than any legal framework to privatize the educational system, to securitize the educational system, and to put all of the educational financing into tradable baskets of securities, leaving the actual education itself, a fundamental plank of society, to rot. So this is the problem, you see. It would be great if these financial engineers were rocketing through past the legal framework and inventing ways to somehow make everyone rich, I guess you could say. But in fact, what they're doing is they're impoverishing millions, and they're causing huge social unrest and huge poverty and starvation and wars. So that's the problem.
Yeah, and you know, Mervyn King has been really at the forefront of this program of quantitative easing and printing hundreds of billions of pounds to then buy treasuries from itself. But, you know, over the last few months since the credit crisis began, banks have been hoarding all this money. So the treasury buys the treasuries from them, the gilts from them, and then they keep the cash on their books at the Bank of England.
Yes.
But for the first time this past month, they've actually started to draw down on those reserves, i.e. they're lending out.
Mm-hmm.
So they drew down 10 billion pounds, which could then be, if it was at a 10-to-1 multiple, they would have lent out 100 billion pounds.
Right.
But they found that almost all of it has gone to housing and mortgage, you know, housing speculation.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually been a negative effect on the small business and personal loans. So all the money is, like, all this quantitative easing is just going into the one thing that caused the whole crisis, which
right.
is this speculation and asset prices.
Right. So the question is the black hole in real estate lending and the 125% mortgages and all that we've been talking about for years, is the increase in the what they call the velocity of money.
Yeah.
That is to say, the banks are now loaning this money that they've been hoarding. It sounds like it's just going to go into this black hole of the real estate nightmare, and it won't trickle down into creating, let's say, more friction in the economy and more inflation. So that's always the big question. The big question is, do we have inflation or deflation? By what you're describing there, the money that the banks have been hoarding entering into circulation, that would be a recipe for inflation. But if it's going to just go into this black hole of busted real estate deals, then it makes no dent into the spiraling deflationary void. So,
other than the fact that most Brits, as you see, they withdraw all their equity, you know, so they pool together, they all buy up in a neighborhood, they drive the prices up and then extract the equity, because on paper it's worth a certain amount.
Yeah.
But they're just extracting equity because nobody has a job, right?
Yeah.
Very few jobs that are pay enough money to actually afford a house.
Mm-hmm.
So the only way it's possible is if the house prices continue to rise.
Right. So you do have the FTSE, which is above 5,000,
yeah.
And you have life in the real estate sector. And is this bubble about to be reinflated? Or is this just a bear market rally? It is the question of the day.
That's exactly right. You have to look at the elements that cause a crisis in the first place. Number one is too much debt to income.
Mm-hmm.
Either incomes have to rise, and as they've been falling for 10 years, it looks like the trend is not their friend in terms of making incomes rise to match the debt. So debt has to come down.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not happening.
Okay, prediction time, prediction time.
Okay, what's your prediction? How long before it begins? What's the next crisis going to be? Is it going to be like commercial banks, or is it going to be federal deficits that are national deficits? Like the OECD, was it the OECD or the IMF? Somebody warned this week that the European Commission warned this week about the UK debt levels, which they said are going to hit 180% of GDP.
Right.
So the BBC also did a Where Did Your Money Go? And they showed the $2.4 trillion spent so far in the UK to bail out banks and stimulus plans, and mostly bailouts, actually. Mm-hmm. In the US, they've spent $3.6 trillion. But on a per capita basis, it's $50,000 per Brit was spent on the bailouts.
Mm-hmm. Prediction time, prediction time.
I think there will be... It'll be a national debt crisis. It'll be somewhere in Europe. It'll be maybe Austria, maybe Spain, maybe Ireland, maybe the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And that will trigger the giant round down.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Oh, well, no, I think it gets back to what we were saying at the beginning of the show. I think it'll be the Mideast.
That would be unusual.
Well, how so?
Well, because most people, that would be against most people's expectations.
Yeah, but that's usually, that's generally how these things happen, isn't it? They always come out of the blue. It's a rogue event. But
Black swan.
Apparently, the region in the world that is on the precipice of another huge debt deflationary prolonging is in the Mideast, and because there's so much cross ownership with all the banks around the world, it would be a huge evaporation of a balance sheet of various banks, and then the debt crisis would be in another new phase.
So Saudi Arabia is kind of unique in that while it, you know, by appearances' sake, they have a lot of oil, they have a huge population and of very young people, unlike, say, Qatar or the UAE. And plus, the Saudi Arabia, more than any other nation, and most other nations in that region, they're very much a vassal state. And it's very expensive to be a client state of America. So they have very little independence, and it costs a lot to be a vassal state. Whereas the UAE, Abu Dhabi, you know, they're a little bit more free.
We'll explore this vassal state concept a little bit.
Well, they have a lot of, you know, they may call themselves kings or prince, but the real king and prince are various military industrial contractors in America to whom they have to pay a lot of money. Why do they always, they're buying, you know, they support Boeing, basically. They have to keep Boeing afloat in exchange for not having their country invaded.
Right, so above and beyond the relationship in oil, it's that military hardware.
Yes.
That's the key.
But that's just them paying the bribes, really. That's them supporting the empire, the emperor.
Right. Okay, so they're a vassal state, and so their money that they spend, they've spent way more on all this military hardware than that oil business can support.
Exactly. Plus, you know, nobody's had a full accounting of how much Gawar, their giant oil field, is producing.
Okay, so then you have the peak oil thing. Phenomenon. Yeah. Right, so you got peak oil kicking in, and the two of the three major fields around the world, we know from reports their reserves are shrinking pretty quickly.
At double-digit rates. That's Bergan in Kuwait and Cantarell in Mexico.
Okay, so we don't hear from Saudi Arabia because they don't make reports available, but it seems pretty good guess that like those other major fields, they are depleting at around the same rate.
Well, according to Zapata George, remember we talked to him last year, and he said that it was, I think they even admit this in Saudi Arabia, but they're pumping water into their giant field, which is a bad sign, and it usually, what you'll often see is precipitous decline from there.
Okay, so everyone's looking at Europe, America, and China. Everyone's looking at, of course, the China-America. China's trying to get out of the dollar. Everyone knows this. China hates the dollar. Everyone knows this. The dollar index is trading at new lows. There's a lot of work around the world to, I believe, to support the dollar, but everyone's attention is focused on those factors. And but if based on the stuff I've been reading in the last couple of weeks, the Saudis and in the Mideast, they've taken on many, many trillions of dollars in debts that are now about to go bust. And this peak oil thing, you know, that was always their trump card. We had the oil. But if they really, if the peak oil, if it really kicks in and it looks like they're never going to be able to pay those debts because their oil has peaked, that could precipitate an enormous credit crunch that would be equal, if not greater in size, than the credit crunch we saw starting in 2007, which would mean all these banks would have to write down huge debts again. And the huge deflationary spiral, the big deflation story, would get back in play. And kind of paradoxically, the price of gold would continue to go up because the price of gold is really a play on economic chaos.
Yeah. Yeah, well, crucially, Saudi Arabia, more than most of those other countries there, has a very, very, very young population of young guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't want 18-year-old guys who are unemployed and hungry living in the desert.
Well, they're thinking about building now, if I just, I just glanced at the article, but now one of these big walls.
Yeah, between them and, not sure which border, but yeah, that was a Raytheon was going to be handed that contract.
Okay, right, big defense contractors. And so they're in debt hugely to these defense contractors. And apparently this, so that's my prediction. My prediction is that the next big seismic catastrophe will come out of the Mideast. It'll be a combination of debt bomb and peak oil. And this will send shockwaves throughout the global banking system. And this rally that we're seeing in the FTSE and other indexes will abruptly come to a halt. And that still leaves, of course, the fate of the U.S. dollar.
But, you know, by the way, you could also see the stress in the Saudi society. Something's going on there for sure, because you've got, wasn't it, Bandar was put under house arrest for trying to overthrow the monarch?
Again? Or what? What's going on? This guy's always in trouble, Bandar.
That was last month.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And then you have those two billionaire families at war with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So these two other aristocrats.
Mm-hmm.
So there seems to be some sort of turmoil going on. Somebody's going to have to lose their billions, it looks like.
Yeah, and these huge developments, you know, like the island project here in the Persian Gulf, looks like it's a big bust. That's hundreds of billions of dollars. And, you know, that's a huge, incredible bust. I mean,
yeah, the Saudis were investing big time in the UAE and in Qatar.
I mean, you know, here we are on the anniversary of 9/11. The Twin Towers.
Here's 9/11.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, the insurance payout for the Twin Towers was $500 million.
I think it was twice what the guy paid for it.
So let's say it's $1 billion, just to be on the safe side here. So now we're talking about, according to the paper today, $300 billion.
Wow.
In a failed real estate project. And there's many more behind that. They just had, you know, when we were there doing our film Peaked Oil, you know, it's one of those, it's like Bangkok in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
It's just cranes everywhere. And it was just this never-ending hundreds and hundreds of cranes as far as the eye could see. Remember, we were in the Ritz in Doha. And you look out the window and you just see hundreds of cranes just putting up, you know, you wake up in the morning and there's like five more floors on the building next door to you that has been constructed overnight. And those workers that they were bringing in were working 24 hours a day and, you know, in 50 degrees centigrade temperatures. And, you know, it was just this amazing explosion of activity. But apparently it's just all come to a grinding halt, like Bangkok in 1997, which we've talked about. You know, you go to Bangkok today and you still see posters up on the wall talking, you know, advertising concerts from 1997, because in 1997, they just came to a huge grinding halt there.
Yeah, well, the other problem with being a vassal state was, you know, remember, Saudi Arabia really, 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 really tried hard to help McCain win.
Yeah.
And they were doing that by trying to flood the market with oil.
Is that right?
Yeah. And they were driving down the price of oil.
Mm-hmm.
But they, their requirements, their budget requirements were such that they needed their oil to be at $80 a barrel just to meet their basic government needs. You know, this was over the last few years with all the inflation and the collapse of the dollar, and plus of their rising, their rapidly rising population there, and lots of young people who are unemployed. Right. So their needs on government are very big. So they needed $80 oil in order to sustain their, you know, their budget requirements.
Right.
Whereas, say, Qatar was operating on like $50, maybe even $40 oil projections,
mm-hmm.
that all their government needs, everything would be met at $40, $50 a barrel.
Right. Yeah, well, certainly when oil was at $147 a barrel.
That was the Goldman Sachs. Like, it went up to for Goldman Sachs.
Sure, but think of all the deals that were, you know, penned, put to paper based on oil being at over 100, 125.
Yeah.
And, you know, all those assumptions have been smashed and shattered. So oil, yeah, I mean, peak oil would suggest, of course, price goes higher, but deflationary spiral in, around the world would suggest demand destruction.
I saw, by the way, I saw that in Mexico,
yeah.
the head of the oil, you know, the oil minister is getting loads of kudos because, you know, the big Pemex, I guess their state oil company,
yeah.
he sold last year, last summer, when oil was on its way to 147, he sold forward contracts for 2009. He locked in $70 a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
Which everybody thought he was crazy because, like, when he did this, it was like at $100 a barrel or something.
Right.
But of course, they've made $6 billion so far, they said, above, or billions above what the price of oil then went to. It went to $30 in January.
Right.
And now it's at $70. But, you know, for the whole first 6 months of the year, he was selling it at twice what the going rate was.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Very nice. Kudos to you.
Bully, bully.
Very nice trade. Well, I mean, that's the appropriate use of futures contracts,
yeah.
you know, to hedge your the underlying business that you're in. But when futures contracts were invented to cover financial products like treasury bonds and currencies, then you ushered in this era of the financial derivative,
yeah.
which quickly became the tail wagging the global financial dog. And now, depending on what Warren Buffett recently called the butterfly effect, when he penned an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, he was talking about how we live in this world of the butterfly effect, which is that anybody defaulting on a mortgage in America can topple a government in some other country. And because of the financial derivative leverage that has really escalated and mounted and extended to many hundreds of trillions and even quadrillions, and it's like the princess and the pea. You remember that story?
I do, honey.
You know, the little princess, even though there were 30 or 40 mattresses, she could still feel the little pea underneath there was irritating her. And this is the deal with the derivatives. Even though you put in 500 trillion, quadrillion, and layer and layer and layer of derivatives, if the underlying little pea, which could be somebody defaulting on their mortgage in a trailer park in Arkansas, goes belly up, the whole pile of derivatives is at risk of crashing down because the leverage is so high. If you're at 100 to 1 leverage, all you need is a 1% move down, and the 100% is wiped out.
Well, that's right. So, you know, speaking of oil and oil derivatives, another story out this week, which we haven't touched upon yet for The Truth About Markets right here on Resonance 104.4 FM in London, is that China this week informed six major banks that their state-owned enterprises can walk away. It's like jingle mail. They can walk away from their oil derivatives. Because apparently Air China and China Eastern Airlines bought on the other side, like what I was just explaining, that the Mexican oil minister bought these, you know, he sold, forward sold his oil for $70 a barrel.
Yeah.
Well, this they bought derivatives that went horribly wrong on their own. So they're having to pay billions of dollars, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Or they would have to, but it looks like they're going to default on this. Now, the article about this story does point out that Goldman Sachs is the biggest counterparty.
Oh, right. Well, so what? I mean, yeah, that may have been meaningful at one point in the history of Goldman Sachs, but we now know that if they're at risk of even losing a penny, they just call up Barack Obama, and he gives them whatever they want, carte blanche, and no questions asked. Just here's a Lloyd Blank fine, gets a Lloyd Blank check over there, CEO of Goldman Sachs. They're not at risk of ever losing a penny, because just like the monarchs of Europe weren't at risk of losing a penny, they just taxed the peasants more.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, during the first Great Depression, and this being the second Great Depression, I know it doesn't feel like it, but it didn't feel like it during the first Great Depression either, I guess. According to Richard Russell, who lived through it, he said it wasn't until like 1931, 32, end of 31, beginning of 32, where people started to jump out windows.
Mm-hmm.
And you started to see people looking really scruffy and starting to get very stressed out.
Right.
But one of the arguments always is that the reason why it became a major global Great Depression was because of that Smoot-Hawley, the tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody started, introducing these protectionist measures.
Yep.
Well, you see, on Friday, apparently Barack Obama is bringing in these tariffs on Chinese tires.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 35% tariff.
Yep, that's right. They love global trade when it's easy and they're making money. And the poor Mexicans are getting the horrible short end of the stick, forcing them to scramble over the border to America because of NAFTA. But when it goes against them, then they want to throw protections. You know, if they were consistent, they would eliminate NAFTA for the same reason. You can't have capitalism on the sunny days and then protectionism and communism on the rainy days. You know, America and these other countries have to figure out and decide what system of economics they want. They just can't pick and choose from day to day based on whatever makes the most for the least.
Yeah, but this could be, we could be seeing the moves on the global chessboard, and we've been talking about this thing between the U.S. and China, the first Great Depression. All these times of great turmoil are often accompanied or caused by shifts in global superpowers or global power.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, from World War One through World War Two, it was basically the end of the British Empire. And this could be just a time where power and wealth or certainly power is transferring to other parts of the world, perhaps China. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of the trillions in wealth at the moment, and they seem to have all the good hand at the moment.
Well, I think that the big banks on Wall Street realize this when the credit, as Chuck Prince of Citigroup said, as long as the music's playing, we're going to keep dancing. This was in 2007. And then like a week or two later, you had the beginning of the credit crunch. A couple of hedge funds went belly up, and these bonds started to be marked down to zero. And this was the beginning of what we call the credit crunch. Now, a year later, approximately, Hank Paulson went before Congress and wrestled $700 billion in blood money from Congress to pay off his buddies at Goldman Sachs, because they realized that the game was up and that this was the only time that they would have to claw back as much wealth as they possibly could, because their businesses, as they had been doing it for so many years, was finished. So that was the rich in America basically repatriating back to the colonial barons of yesteryear the money that they had loaned out during this experiment called the American United States of America. But then the colonial barons, and starting in 2007, said, wait a minute, we're not playing this game anymore. We want our money back. And that was the beginning of it. And they are safely ensconced in accounts way out of the reach of any regulatory authority. And they hold lots of gold. And gold is moving higher.
Well, your theory is actually supported by that BBC program about the last days of Lehman Brothers. One of the first scenes, as soon as Hank Paulson emerges anyway, introduced into the script, he says to the group of bankers like Jamie Dimon, John Mack, John Thane, all these guys are sitting around a table, Lloyd Blankfein, and they don't seem to be understanding the significance of what's going on. So Hank Paulson says, "You guys don't get it, do you? We're all going to be speaking Chinese. The power, you know," he's basically saying everything is moving to China if we don't sort this out now. And he said, "And if we sort this out now, maybe we can get it, keep it going for just another few years."
Yeah, he said it's the end of the West.
It's the end of the West, yeah.
Western civilization. And the end of the experiment known as the United States of America. The end of America, the democratic experiment. And I really believe that it has come to an end because all of the wealth that was loaned to the folks in the U.S. to do the land man on the moon and create the hula hoop and laptop computers and it's being repatriated, it's being reclaimed, it's being repossessed, it's gone into foreclosure. Democracy's in foreclosure, and the colonial barons are taking their money back, and they don't want to play anymore. And it was great fun while it lasted, and, you know, the stuffy old plutocrats from Europe got to rub elbows with some cute Hollywood chickses, but now it's back to business as usual, feudalism.
Yeah, but all you have is a democracy. Now you realize that your republics are gone, however, i.e. the rule of law. There are no more laws. There's no habeas corpus. There are no ancient rights of man. There's just the right to vote in a you know, electronic voting booth.
Controlled by, now there's only one company because Diebold bought out the competitor.
Yeah.
Or the competitor bought Diebold. But there were two major electronic voting companies. Now they merged. Now there's only one. There's no accountability, no trails, no voting accountability. So, democracy is what you have, but you can vote all day you want, but it's not how you vote, it's how your vote is counted.
They're going to have to start doing the, you know, make it a more of a, you know, reality TV or more like photo ops. They've got to do something like, for Americans, like if they could dip their finger in, you know, purple dye like the Iraqis did, but maybe another color. Maybe they
red, white, and blue.
Yeah, red, white, and blue. They're three fingers. They could put three fingers in there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, make it something. They have to entertain the masses while they're pretending to engage in any real choice.
Well, Sidney Pollack made that great film at the beginning of his career, They Shoot Horses, Don't They? About the Depression and people marathon dancing themselves to death. And this is the way Americans are going to survive in one way or another. They'll be, you know, pie-eating contests will become much more important as a way to survive. You know, my dad's a champion pie eater. He makes $40,000 a year. He weighs 3 tons, and he's got diabetes, and he'll shortly be dead. But gosh, what a great guy.
Yeah. Well, we do have the choice, I guess. We always get the option. You get to vote for the J.P. Morgan guy or Goldman Sachs' guy. Which one do you want to run your country?
Yeah, that's the big choice now. And I guess it seems as though Barack Obama's a Goldman Sachs guy.
Yeah, I think he's more a Goldman Sachs
guy. He's heading for Goldman Sachs, whereas Tony Blair went to J.P. Morgan.
Yeah.
But J.P. Morgan has a tradition of a white shoe firm, you know. This is more of the C of E image. Goldman Sachs is not that persuasion, and you know, that's probably Barrick will hang with the folks down on Broad Street. They've got that cool server that they look co-located next to the New York Stock Exchange, the cash siphon. And I was talking to Jesse Ventura about that yesterday. And, you know, it's great. You get $100 million a day, I think, by some estimates over there at Zero Hedge. Just siphon that cash out with your algorithmic trading. And it's not exactly capitalism by any stretch of the imagination, but it's a great way to finance your chateau payments.
And, well, you have to keep the moat supplied with alligators and crocodiles.
That's right, little. How much time left in this particular broadcast?
8 more minutes, anybody.
Well, let's see. I see, who's this? Look, there's the most overpaid entertainer in the history of the world, Jonathan Ross. The BBC presenter. Canary Wharf.
Oh, yeah.
He's doing a charity to raise money for September 11 fund.
Yeah, this most bizarre, freaky thing. So they sent some celebrities down there to trade. You can see even a monkey can trade.
Yeah, there he is, Jonathan Ross. the most overpaid entertainer in British history on the floor down there at Canary Wharf. We were talking about that earlier, that shouldn't the BBC be more of a spawning ground for new talent instead of subsidizing geezers?
You can't say that, though, because, you know, even if you read the comments on some, the Times, like, they'll have comments in their stories of, like, oh, the BBC is reconsidering their Jonathan Ross contract because he is paid too much. Most people, and like I said, we're living in neo-feudal times, and they believe that there should be plutocrats and people being paid this much from the public purse because they think that they have hopes that one day they might be like that.
Well, plus also many people enjoy being peasants. They enjoy the simplicity of it. You know, they don't have to make many decisions.
It used to be simple when you were a peasant because the Lord took care of you, but they don't even take care of you now. Well, they don't even have to take care of you.
UK peasants, you know, they get the cheap hydrogenated cooking oil, trans fats down there at the local fast food joint, and they get some, you know, cheap access to credit. And
that, I just came up with an idea for me to run my own party here in London.
What's
that? I think if we're going to have neo-feudalism, that I want the rights of peasants back. I want the lords to be able to have to take care of us. They have to give us some shelter on their lands.
Right.
And give us some beans.
When did they lose that? They had that for a while, and then they lost it, the rights of peasants. And
there were the obligations the Lord had to take care of them. They had to come show up for a festival every twice a year as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then this was going on for hundreds of years, and then there was some shift.
Yeah, but then, like, this so-called democracy and capitalism and all this, like, you could work your way up happened. But if that's no longer possible, then I think we should bring back the rights of peasants.
Yeah, all these people getting asbos and struggling with being surveyed upon and all of the inhumility, the indignity that comes with being part of the surveillance state, they should, instead of trying to struggle and force their way up, they should reach back and really understand the what the peasants had and reclaim their rights as peasants.
So that's it. Today I will declare my candidacy for the peasant party.
That sounds really good. I think that there should be a very forceful stand taken on behalf of the peasants. I mean, everybody in Britain who's not working in Goldman Sachs is basically a peasant, and there are a lot of rights that can come with being a peasant. And I think you make a good point there.
But you have to identify yourself first as a peasant, because there is no chance of you being a J.P. Morgan oligarch. You know, those positions are reserved.
Not with education now completely out of reach for 99.9999% of the population. You know, it costs $100,000 a year to go to some Ivy League school so you can be lording it over the peasants. Well, if that's not for you, then, you know, you should have a much stronger peasant presence.
Yeah, but it's also become, just like I was saying, that we have democracy, but we don't have the republic anymore. We don't have laws anymore. So democracy means F all, right?
Yeah.
Well, the same thing with education. You see, like, you see this, I posted a story this week, Educational Gresham's Law. So the bad is driving out the good. So everybody is now getting, it's almost 100% pass rates on the A-levels now.
Mm-hmm.
That compares to 58% in the 1960s.
Right.
So either people are becoming incredibly smarter,
mm-hmm,
teenagers,
mm,
or their standards are lowering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you see, in America, of course, they had slaves, but they never had peasants, really.
No.
So that's a new concept for them. You know, AmericanPeasant.com, that could be a huge, growth site. As people just give up even trying to fight for health care.
Well, each one. So it should be BritishPeasant.com, FrenchPeasant.com, mm-hmm, GermanPeasant.com, DutchPeasant.com.
The whole health care debate, they're never going to get health care. I mean, the insurance company oligarchs are too entrenched. You're never going to get health care. So just, you know, forget it. Just go back to being a peasant and fight for peasant rights. Because the peasants, what are the rights that they get? Twice a year they get a jubilee or a fair or something?
Well, you get to pick what oligarch you want to serve.
Okay.
So, say Jamie Dimon is, you know, peasant A's choice. Mm-hmm. And maybe Lloyd Blankfein is peasant B's choice.
Okay.
So, Lloyd Blankfein would then have to take care of his peasant.
Mm-hmm.
Like, provide some sort of obligation to them. They have to actually, you know, if one of Jamie Dimon's peasants, for example, gets behind the wheel of a car drunk and drives over Lloyd Blankfein's peasant,
right?
Then Lloyd Blankfein has to go to Jamie Dimon and say, your peasant drove over my peasant. You owe my peasant's family money.
Right.
So they fight for your rights like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to have a festival for you, like a feast at least once a year.
Right.
For all of his peasants.
Okay. Right.
So, you know, these are some of the rights you get. But you have to fight for him. So if he goes to war with Jamie Dimon,
right,
you have to go fight his peasants.
Mm-hmm.
They don't actually go to war physically with each other. They just send their peasants to
exactly
to fight each other.
Right. Well, that's good for the kids, you know. It gets off that nervous energy that they have as teenagers and young adults.
Yeah.
Then go out and fight each other, you know. They're doing it now in the video games and online simulating death simulator, comrade, Marine Corps, death squads. You know, get out of the video games and get into a real fight with the peasants of your peasant class for one of the oligarchs and lords from another bank. Yeah, that seems to be a lot more fun, you know.
Yeah,
and instead of that, yeah, go ahead.
So all these tent cities, I guess they should just, instead of going into a parking lot,
right,
they could go to, you know, Jamie Dimon's backyard, one of his backyards.
Yeah.
And pitch tent there, and all right,
they should bring back thatched roofs and things, you know, to make it more organic looking and ecologically sound. You know, Jamie Dimon doesn't want tarpaulin plastic tents in his backyard. He probably would prefer thatched roofs, and, you know, it's all very quaint and whatnot. And he gets organic butter and organic cheese made by the peasants, and it was a good symbiotic relationship, the lords and the peasants. And this is, in a sense, either you're going to be in jail and make money for the lords that way, or you can be a peasant, and, you know, a peasant's better because you get some fresh air and you get some organic
goat cheese. You have to work 18 hours a day, but
yeah, well, you're doing that anyway. You know, we're being in prison or working, you know, making a dollar by, you know, performing with a dancing chicken on a hot plate is not easy either.
Dancing with a chicken on a hot plate? What?
You know, there was always this great thing in Times Square when in the 70s, they actually had dancing chickens.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
You put a quarter in the machine and the chicken is on an electrified metal disc and it's electrocuting the chicken and it dances. You know, it's the dancing chicken. You know, that's when you really had freaks and geeks and circus freaks, you know, really were still out on the street.
Some guy dressed as King Kong in the 1970s picked me up. I was a little girl, and he picked
me
up.
You like that kind of thing?
And he
ran down the street. Should I put on a gorilla suit?
We gotta go now.
Oh, well, bye, y'all.